to day on Against the Grain. What's the longest and most expensive war in U.S. history? The answer? The ongoing war in Afghanistan. I'm C.S. Benjamin Hopkins describes the war's corrosive effect on U.S. democracy and also discusses his latest book, Ruling the Savage Periphery, Frontier Governance and the Making of the Modern State, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. For almost 20 years, the U.S. has been at war in Afghanistan, with no end, no definitive end, in sight. What impact has the conflict had on U.S. democracy, on this country's civic norms, body politic, and finances? It's a sobering picture, a story almost entirely hidden from sight, which brings up another question: why? Why isn't the U.S. war in Afghanistan openly discussed and debated? Why aren't its enormous costs to people both in the U.S. and in Afghanistan brought to the forefront of public consciousness? Benjamin Hopkins, a scholar specializing in the history of Afghanistan and the Indian subcontinent, believes that the war in Afghanistan has fundamentally and irrevocably damaged the U.S. He has published an article in the journal Critical Asian Studies with the title, The War That Destroyed America, Afghanistan's Coming Bill. Benjamin Hopkins is Associate Professor of History and International Affairs at the George Washington University. His latest book is Ruling the Savage Periphery, Frontier Governance and the Making of the Modern State. You'll hear more about that book later this hour. When Ben and I connected recently, he began with something George Marshall, the general who oversaw the U.S. war effort in World War II, once said.
So the article begins with a quotation from Marshall in the late 1940s when he's actually the Secretary of State overseeing the famed Marshall Plan that bears his name for the reconstruction of Europe. And Marshall says, kind of offhandedly, that he believes a democracy cannot survive a 7 years war. Of course, he said this bearing in mind his experience as chief of staff of the U.S. Army during the Second World War, which really meant he was in charge of the logistics and the home front of the war effort. And I think that experience made him acutely aware of the cost of what was a total war on American society. And I think that really is reflected in his statement and his sentiment that war just wears down democratic societies, and there are limits to how much they can take.
How costly financially, you know, in dollar terms, for the U.S. has been the war in Afghanistan, and how does that amount compare with what the U.S. has spent on other military operations?
That's a rather frightening question, as a matter of fact. I need to give a shout out to the amazing work that Brown University has done in their Cost of War project, which has just done incredible work really piecing together this. The short answer is that the war in Afghanistan, we think, has cost around $2 trillion in terms of direct allocations from Congress to the State Department, to the Department of Defense and such. And the broader global war on terror, of which it is part, has cost around $6.4 trillion. This makes both Afghanistan, but also the larger war on terror, the most expensive conflict in American history, inflation adjusted even more expensive than the Second World War. And one of the things about that is that it's almost wholly debt financed, which is an abrogation from previous practice. And most of that debt financing has come from overseas investors, as opposed to previous debt financed wars, such as the First and Second World War, where liberty bonds and victory bonds were held by American citizens. A lot of the debt that has financed this war has been financed particularly by China. The other thing is that there are, you know, costs to this war which are difficult to quantify. Opportunity cost, the cost of future medical care for wounded veterans, the cost of replacement for vehicles and parts that are worn out, which really make it a moving target, but extraordinarily high.
And just to clarify, the fact that China has financed much of this debt does not mean, correct, that the U.S. public is not on the hook for that money?
Well, China owns it in the form of U.S. treasuries, so the U.S. taxpayer ultimately has to pay back those treasuries at some point. I don't want to sound an alarmist and overstate the case. After all, for example, the British government only paid off the Napoleonic war bonds at the end of the 20th century. But I think it's important for listeners to be aware of the magnitude of this war debt, which really dwarfs, almost anything else on the ledger of expenses for the U.S. federal government.
How about the cost of the Afghanistan war on U.S. lives, the numbers of dead and the numbers of wounded?
As with the financial cost, I think the seeming definiteness of this number is somewhat misleading. I mean, if you go to the Department of Defense, they have it through September of 2020, and 2,349 U.S. personnel have been killed, and 20,149 have been wounded, as well as another 3,814 military contractors since the American invasion in 2001. And that sounds like a very definite, very specific number. But what it doesn't include are after-action deaths, which include, the fate of suicides amongst American veterans who suffer from PTSD and such. And the specificity of the American casualties, of course, has to be juxtaposed with the ambiguity of Afghan casualties. We think that the number of dead and wounded civilians and non-combatants, as well as combatants in Afghanistan, is somewhere around 140,000, but we really don't know. And that says nothing of the nearly 5.5 million people who have been displaced by the war since the American intervention in 2001.
Yeah, and certainly it's important to mention that, because although your article focuses, and I think very compellingly, on the costs to the U.S., both materially and kind of immaterially, obviously we have to acknowledge the incredible damage done to Afghan lives and to the environment. To what extent is the Afghan war being prosecuted from the air? And will that be affected by a reduction, any reduction in the number of U.S. troops in Afghanistan? And I'm thinking of the one announced by Trump last year.
It's not simply that it's a war that is increasingly being prosecuted from the air, but it's increasingly being prosecuted from the air by drones, by unmanned drones. Since the early days of the American occupation and efforts in Afghanistan, articles both in the public and scholarly about how these drones are being flown actually out of bases in South Dakota, which just further removes the drone operators from the acts of violence they're perpetrating. And of course, some of these drones come under the jurisdiction of the Department of Defense, which then President Trump's announcement in November of 2020 that he would be reducing American forces in Afghanistan down to 2,500, of course, did not apply to non-Pentagon assets. So the CIA assets, assets being run by other departments in the United States government, and also didn't make any statement about the drone and air war, which continues unabated, and also across administrations. I think that's something that is a bipartisan issue. It's a war that's been waged publicly, but also covertly across administrations since American intervention in 2001.
When you say that it's been waged, this war in Afghanistan's been waged covertly, how does that tie into your article's emphasis on the fact that no one really talks about this war. It didn't appear in the 2020 election campaign cycle, nor in the one before it in 2016. We're talking about the presidential election campaigns. I mean, is that partly what you're gesturing toward, that policymakers don't seem to make any, or don't seem to be willing to make any, overt statements about this war's prosecution?
I think there's two elements to that question, CS. On the one hand, there's the kind of intentional obscuring of the war. And that intentional obscuring goes to a kind of silence about it publicly from government officials. It's an intentional silence. They don't talk about it. And that certainly is the case. But there's also just a kind of indifference that affects not only the American political class, the American media, but I think the American public about this. The term that has emerged over the past 2 years to describe this, as well as Yemen and the war in Iraq, are the forgotten wars. And we need to remember that forgetting is often an intentional act. It's not just kind of a sedimentation of the past in our minds, but it's actually actively pursued. And so I think that's definitely the case in Afghanistan, where we do have a certain extent of an obscuring of the war by not talking about it. But we also just have an intentional act of social forgetting that infects our society from the political class to the press to the broader public at large.
Benjamin Hopkins is our guest on Against the Grain. I'm C.S. Song. He teaches history and international affairs at the George Washington University, where he directs the Sigar Center for Asian Studies. And an article that he wrote called The War That Destroyed America, Afghanistan's Coming Bill, recently appeared in the journal Critical Asian Studies. What tropes about the people and culture of Afghanistan circulate among policymakers and also members of the general public in the U.S. that you think are damaging and destructive and prevent people from either gaining knowledge about Afghanistan and this conflict, or even maybe desiring to gain such knowledge?
I think often the starting point with foreign places in general, but Afghanistan in particular, is that in the public mind, these places don't exist before the American encounter. So Afghanistan doesn't exist before 2001, or you push it back a generation, before the Soviet invasion in 1979. And that has always struck me as very odd, because the United States has actually had a longstanding relationship with Afghanistan dating back two centuries ago. At the same time, there is an entrapment of Afghanistan in both the popular and policy imagination by very staid tropes about it. You see this in the popular press. You see this in some of the products of government papers on this. You see this in just the way people talk about it, that it's tribal. Afghanistan is a land of tribalism. Afghanistan is a land of Islamic fundamentalism or religious fundamentalism. It's a pre-modern kind of land where ties of blood and kinship trump issues of politics. These are the ways we caricature Afghans and Afghan society. And in many ways, it's a self-exculpatory exercise, because in doing so, what it means is that we are not responsible for the disaster that the war has brought. The war has failed, or American efforts have failed, because of Afghanistan's tribal politics, its religious fanaticism, its corrupt politicians. It's not got anything to do, according to this kind of thinking, with bad American policy or bad American actions. It's their fault, not our fault. And part of this, of course, I think is intentional, because it excuses us of responsibility. Part of it is also, I don't want to say laziness, because I don't think that's true, but, you know, it's difficult. This is a place that the language is difficult to access. The culture is very different than our own. It takes study. There's very few scholars that have an in-depth knowledge of this space. And so it becomes easy to caricature. But that caricature of this space and these people really do condemn them to a responsibility for the violence that marks their country, which is not solely their own.
So, Benjamin Hopkins, in your article, The War That Destroyed America, Afghanistan's Coming Bill, you write that Afghanistan may be the war that ultimately destroys American democracy as we know it, that the war has undermined basic democratic norms in the U.S. Make that argument for us.
If I could be so bold, C.S., I wouldn't say it's the war that will do. I'd say it's the war that has done. It's just that we haven't recognized it yet because we haven't been paying attention. I mean, we already talked about the fiscal costs of the war, which make it the most expensive conflict in American history. We've talked about the bodies, both Afghan and American, that the war has begot. But what's almost totally ignored from most of the accounting of the war is an accounting of its social and political costs. And these are massive. These are manifesting themselves today, I would argue, in our country and continuing to and will over time, whether it be the integration of battlefield-tested surveillance technologies like iris scans, which of course are beta tested or begin on the battlefield in Iraq and Afghanistan, and now are part of security features on our iPhones, facial recognition. Whether it be something like the militarization of American policing. I mean, now it's a topic of great public interest and debate, how the American police forces have been recipients of discarded U.S. military hardware, how they receive training, which in many ways, you know, mimics counterinsurgency training from the American military, how in many ways the American police have become militarized, or how the judiciary in the United States, for instance, gives a pass, almost a blank check, a non-accountability check, as it were, to the executive in terms of the actions that they take in Afghanistan, whether it be a drone war, which is probably illegal, whether it be the use of black sites and torture, which is definitely illegal, whether it be weird legal spaces like Guantanamo, which though we haven't said it's legal nor illegal, nobody else really recognizes. I mean, these are massive costs that are eroding our civil liberties and our civil society. And the other place that it intersects is, frankly, in many ways, the war is an extension of the American empire. And there has been a huge body of scholarship that has recognized the intricate link between modern imperialism and racism. And we can, I would argue, see that the way that we otherize or other and treat Afghan bodies or those of Muslims as part of the global war on terror really does have a return effect on American streets, where we other people in particular of a darker skin pigmentation. These are reinforcing tendencies of political power that, though authored perhaps on a foreign field, manifest themselves in our own country and continue to and are going to gain speed over time. So again, I wouldn't say this will be the war. I say this is the war that has already done so. It's just we have not woken up to the damage that it's wrought.
Is the Afghan war, is it winnable? And if not, can the U.S. or will the U.S. extricate itself from it?
That is an impossible question, because the real question is, what is victory? Why is the United States in this war? What is our war aim? And that's actually one of the issues that the article argues, that we have not had a clear war aim. So you can't win if you don't know what you're fighting for. And I think that that inability to win or conversely lose is going to remain prescient until we clarify what our war aims are in Afghanistan. And I would say that if we ever did have that conversation, which I'm not sure we will, they're definitely different today than they would have been in 2001. Can we extricate ourselves? Again, what would that look like? What does that mean? Can we draw down to 2,500 U.S. American uniformed servicemen at at Bagram? Probably. The flip side of that would be an increase in clandestine forces, would be my guess. Do we want to, or rather, do policymakers in Washington want to? I mean, if you follow the language that they're talking about, in particular, the supposed great power rivalry with China, with the Belt and Road Initiative, I think there will probably be less and less of an interest in winding down the war, or rather, winding down the American presence in Afghanistan. And I think that's really a problem, because there's not a clear public discussion or reckoning of either the issue of what does it mean to win, what does victory mean here, or what does it mean to withdraw here.
And to return to the issue of tropes, you know, the tropes, as you mentioned, of a kind of timeless ethnic strife in Afghanistan, hopelessly unchecked corruption, religious fanaticism. If these are tropes applied, maliciously or otherwise, to Afghanistan and its people by U.S. policymakers and the U.S. public, what is the reality? What reality can you share with us that these tropes conceal?
The first thing I would say is I'd point to a brilliant book by a colleague of mine, Robert Cruz at Stanford University, that I think the title of the book actually really captures the issue. And the title of the book is Afghan Modern, that Afghanistan and the people who inhabit this space are modern. They are fundamentally modern, just like us. They have politics like us. They have, you know, economic strife just like us. That many of the issues that mark this society and this country are not dissimilar, though the vernacular might be different. The underlying issues are not different than our own. At the same time, I don't want to erase the particularity of their historical experience. I mean, let's remember that the war is entering the 20th year for the United States, and the 42nd year, actually 43rd year for Afghans. Afghanistan has been at war since 1978 with the Saur Revolution, which is incredible. I myself am 43, and to think, you know, that it's not only an entire generation, but two generations. If you look at the population pyramid of Afghanistan, the number of people born after the American invasion in 2001 is actually the majority of the population of the country. So if you go back to the Soviet invasion in 79, it's even greater. So we need to think about, you know, the destructive and dislocative effects of that. And we need to also juxtapose that with the fact that Afghans are extraordinarily globally entwined. If you make a list of the 10 largest Afghan cities in the world, only five are in Afghanistan itself. The other ones include places like Ekaterinburg in the Urals in Russia, Hamburg in Germany, London, where I live, the Washington, D.C. metro area, and also the Bay Area in San Francisco are large Afghan metropolises. So, you know, what kind of society does this create? And it's one that I think is much more dynamic than these tropes about tribalism, tribal past, kinship, and blood give rise to. And I think that for us to fully understand that is, yes, complicated and hard, but we need to recognize that the language with which we are defining this place and these people is insufficient, if not wrong, and that we need to find a language which is both more accurate and more relatable for us. And once we find that language, I think we can better understand the issues and problems facing both Afghanistan internally, as well as our relationship with Afghanistan.
So, Ben, your most recent book is Ruling the Savage Periphery, Frontier Governance and the Making of the Modern State. And your book is indeed about the making, the construction of the modern bureaucratic state system. You focus on the late 19th century. Why did you choose to tell the story of the making of states through the lens of frontiers and peripheral territories instead of the centers of power?
Well, C.S., I've always been interested in the kind of peripheral or frontier spaces of states. And in my own area of specialty, South Asian history, generally, and that of Afghanistan in particular. This is a space that looms large in the historical record. I mean, the frontier of Afghanistan with British India is a place that produced a large amount of violence, unfortunately, but also a large amount of public attention and reporting. For example, Winston Churchill famously writes as a reporter for one of the London newspapers while he's part of the Malakand Field Force in 1897. So I think this is a really important space that has often been overlooked in the history, not only of South Asia, but also more globally. As the book argues, the so-called frontier, and I just bring attention to the fact that I define the frontier not as a place, but as a practice, or rather as a set of discrete practices which are constituted in a place, that these are often thought of as kind of the afterwards, the exceptional spaces, by historians and the public in general when we think about state construction. And my argument is that actually, no, these are the spaces where the state experiments, it cuts its teeth, it learns how to govern, and it often actually reintegrates the lessons it learns there into the so-called centers of state power. So that's really why I've been focused on that space. And in this book particularly, what the book tries to do is demonstrate that the specific story that plays out along the what was then British Indian frontier with the nascent state of Afghanistan is replicated globally, not only throughout the British Empire, but also in other spaces as well, such as in the American Empire during the American expansion continentally westward, as well as in the Argentine Republic in the late 19th century.
Now, the people who are governed in these peripheral territories on these frontiers are often indigenous people. Are those the people you are focusing on your book to the extent that the way the state treats these people, the way it governs them, is important to understanding how states operate more generally?
So I would say two things about that. Number one, I would just clarify what I can and can't say as a historian, or rather what I specifically can say as me. And that is that the book is really about the states rather than the indigenous people, because there is a very important story about indigenous agency and indigenous reactions to state interventions and state powers in these spaces that I frankly don't do justice to, at least as far as I'm concerned, in the book. And that's for a different historian to write, and I certainly hope it will, or a historian will in future. In terms of your question about the actions of state actors on these indigenous people, on the one hand, there's historians that would argue, you know, this is a particular case, or in the words of the Italian theorist Agamben, that this is a space of exception. It's a unique and not universalizable story. However, the position that I take in my book is actually, no, not at all. These exceptions are present throughout the late 19th century world and well into the 20th and indeed 21st century world. And so to think of these spaces, these frontiers, or the people that interact with the state in these spaces as somehow exceptional is to, I think, misunderstand the plurality of political power that states exercise today. We think there's a norm, a universal norm in the form of, say, in the United States, you know, the Constitution, everybody's treated equal according to the law, et cetera, et cetera. And then if you're not, that's kind of an exceptional case that we can bracket out. And yet, actually, if you start to look at all the exceptional cases, even in some place that claims to have a universal rule of law like the United States, in many ways, those exceptional cases outnumber and outweigh the quote unquote normal case. And I think that's really one of the key points of the argument that the book makes.
You mentioned your book's argument that frontiers are not places, but rather practices, and you argue that four practices constitute frontiers. Can you lay out and summarize each one? I mean, I know there's a lot to say about these practices, but if you could encapsulate them.
It's fantastic you use that word encapsulate, because that's precisely what's going on here in terms of how the state treats the indigenous inhabitants of the spaces that are being discussed here. The state is encapsulating these people, both in territory, but also a jurisdictional space. That said, yes, I understand frontiers as a set of practices rather than places. And let me just really quickly say why. Because on the one hand, if I say frontier, most people will think of a particular place. Say my own specialty, the frontier between British India and Afghanistan, which is currently the frontier between Pakistan and Afghanistan. And that's fine, because that particular frontier is marked by a definiteness. It doesn't move over time. Yet if we think, for instance, of the United States during the 19th century, the frontier is always moving. And indeed, one of the things I talk about in my book is Frederick Jackson Turner's famous essay from 1893, when he talks about the closing of the American frontier. So how do you make sense of a frontier as a place if it's on the one hand both permanent and on the other hand moving? And the way I try to address this is by understanding or conceptualizing the frontier as practice. And as you say, to me, a frontier is constituted by four discrete practices that are present elsewhere, both in the colonial and imperial sphere, but also in the national sphere. It's when they come together in this unique combination of four that we find a frontier. Okay, so what are these four practices? Well, the first is what I call indirect rule, ruling through a local chief or a local headman, whether that be an Afghan malik or a Native American chief. The second, I argue, is what I call sovereign pluralism or layered sovereignty. You know, a lot of political scientists today like to think of sovereignty as an absolute state. You either have it or you don't. But as a historian, I know it's almost infinitely divisible, not only conceptually, but in practice, that empires and states have long divided up sovereignty. In the United States, we do it today. We just don't recognize it as such. Instead, we call it federalism. So indirect rule, sovereign pluralism. The third is what I call imperial objecthood. And that is invariably the indigenous peoples that are acted upon in this frontier space are objects of action. And what I mean by that is they're acted upon by colonial authorities or national authorities without the opportunity, whether it be meaningful or not, for redress, in particular through some sort of judicial recourse. So to put it in more concrete terms, these people lack any standing in court to take the actions of the imperial power or the national power and challenge them in court. A great example from the United States is that it's not until the 1870s that individual Native Americans are even recognized as persons in the eyes of the law. So the United States government can do things to them and they have no redress in court, even though they're subject to the laws of the United States. Same too on the Afghan frontier and the other places I look. And then the fourth and final element of frontier practice is economic dependency, that these people are rendered economically dependent on a larger surrounding national or colonial economy. They're invariably drawn into relationships of wage labor, where that relationship is stacked against them. And so it's very unfavorable. So it's these four elements: indirect rule, sovereign pluralism, imperial objecthood, and economic dependency. When you see these working together and manifest in a particular territorial place, there you have a frontier. And I call that practice in its totality frontier governmentality.
Benjamin Hopkins is his name. He's Associate Professor of History and International Affairs at the George Washington University. His latest book is Ruling the Savage Periphery, Frontier Governance and the Making of the Modern State. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So your book features discussions about many locales around the globe. There's locations in Africa, in South America, in South Asia, and in the U.S. Can you kind of lay out the specific locations that you describe and try to explain the governmentality within in your book?
Yeah. So the book begins with my own area of specialty, which is the northwest frontier of British India, the frontier between Afghanistan and modern-day Pakistan, and in particular, looking at a space which is today called the FATA, or the federally administered tribal areas. And I remember running into those for the first time and looking at them and thinking, these are very odd spaces, but also I've seen these spaces before. And it immediately made me think, having grown up in the United States, of my very rudimentary knowledge of Native American reservations. They were reservations. Are reservations, I should say, because they still exist. That was kind of my starting point. The other thing that I would say to kind of put this in perspective is what I did was there's a particular law in effect in the FATA, the federally administered tribal agencies between Afghanistan and Pakistan, called the Frontier Crimes Regulation. And this was the proverbial end of the string that I started to pull on, because it's a very odd law. But I started to pull on it and realized that this law becomes a blueprint globally around the world for the British Empire, that it gets replicated, or it first passed along that frontier in 1872, and then replicated around British India, for instance, along the frontier between British India and Burma, or today India and Myanmar. And then it travels. It has an imperial career. It goes to Iraq in 1914. It goes to Palestine, it goes to Transjordan, it goes to northern Nigeria, it goes to Kenya-Somali borderland. Elements of it end up in South Africa. And so it has a global career, actually, that follows the British Empire. But I stepped back from that point and thought, well, it's not formally replicated outside the British Empire, but substantively it is, because it has these elements of frontier governmentality, the four elements, the indirect rule, sovereign pluralism, imperial objecthood, and economic dependence. And so then I took the original thought that I had, that these spaces look like Native American reservations in the United States, and I started to look at the San Carlos Apache Reservation in southern Arizona. And sure enough, the same story emerges with the emergence of a tribal police force, a tribal court system. All these elements of frontier governmentality emerge. What's really interesting is within 5 years of their emergence on the Afghan frontier, the same thing is happening in Arizona in the 1870s. And then finally, I also looked at Argentina to look outside the Anglosphere and to look at other spaces in the world. And again, we see the same sort of thing happening. And again, interestingly, at the same time, during what the Argentines refer to as the conquest of the desert between 1875 and 1885, where reservations are kind of being set up. They don't actually work out in Argentina, but all these elements of frontier governmentality are being replicated there. And I would say, just in conclusion briefly, there are other places that I know it gets replicated, but I neither had the space in the book, nor frankly, the linguistic competence to explore those. And I certainly hope that other historians perhaps take up that call and look elsewhere to where this might have been present.
Tell me a little bit more about what you found out about the San Carlos Apache Reservation. You just mentioned that you saw all four practices, the practices you argue constitute frontiers, in operation in that area in the late 19th century. What did you find most striking about the confluence of these practices and the way the U.S. government treated people in these areas?
So I mentioned previously that this frontier governmentality along the Anglo-Afghan frontier is best encapsulated in this law, the Frontier Crimes Regulation, but it's also personified in a number of colonial agents and colonial servants that I look at in the book. The most important of whom is a man named Robert Sandeman, who really brings this system to southern Afghanistan in the 1870s. In the San Carlos situation, I could find no direct linkage between British administrators and American administrators. They weren't necessarily reading each other and stuff. But on San Carlos, really interestingly, there's an individual who emerges at the same time as Robert Sandeman is doing what he's doing for frontier governmentality on the Afghan frontier. And this is a man named John Philip Klum, who's doing the same thing on the San Carlos reservation in the Arizona Territory in the 1870s. And Klum actually, there's a movie about him starring Audie Murphy. It's a terrible movie. I think it's called Walk the Proud Land, that's produced in 1952. But even though Klum doesn't do a proverbial carbon copy of the Frontier Crimes Regulation, so he's not doing the exact same law, nonetheless, independent of what the British are doing contemporaneously along the Afghan frontier, he comes up with exactly the same set of practices. So he creates a tribal police force where he recruits the holders of authority from the various Native American tribes that are encapsulated on this reservation. And he pays them to basically police the other Native Americans on the reservation. So he does this thing where he monetizes them at the same time he monitors them. So he's making them economically dependent upon the goodwill and labor of the United States government and having them police themselves. He also introduces a tribal court to the reservation in which the inhabitants of the reservation become judged by their own customs and traditions, authentic customs and traditions, of course, being arbitrated by Klum himself. This, again, is very similar to the kind of indirect rule through headmen, through chiefs, on the Native American reservation. As I said previously, the inhabitants of any American reservation in 1872 are not recognized by law as individuals. It's not until the 1870s, I believe it's the Crow Dog case, when individual Indians actually receive a standing in the face of American law so that they're treated collectively. They can be acted upon by the federal government, but they're certainly not citizens. They're not even subjects of the US national law, that they're some sort of outsiders, but not quite outsiders like real foreigners, like Mexicans or Brits or whatever. So on all four points of frontier governmentality, indirect rule, sovereign pluralism, because of course the reservation is, in the famous words of John Marshall, the justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, a quote-unquote domestic dependent nation. Imperial objects, so they don't have standing in court, and economic dependence. All these are coming together between 1874, when Klum arrives on the San Carlos Reservation, 1877, when he leaves. And one could say, well, that's an interesting little anecdote about this one guy on the reservation. But the thing about Klum is that many of his policies on the San Carlos Reservation actually become the template that is subsequently taken up by the U.S. Congress. So actually, Congress subsequently passes a law for Indian police forces on reservations throughout the United States and tribal courts.
That's Benjamin Hopkins. He's an historian based at the George Washington University. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Are you making an argument in this book, Ben, that the geographical peripherality, if that's a word, of these people and these areas corresponds with a sense among political elites that, you know, these people really are kind of peripheral, that, you know, we don't want them too close, you know, actually too physically close to the seats of power and, you know, at the border, dwelling on the border, having them at the border means that we can treat them differently. We can take less responsibility over them.
So there's a couple of parts that your question really raises. One is, I wouldn't say the geographical distance as much as the ecological distance, because at the end of the day, there's kind of a simple cost-benefit analysis I think imperial powers or national powers are making in their relations with these problematic indigenous peoples. And it's a pretty simple story that you have a group of people that are seen by national or imperial authorities as recalcitrant to normal administration. They inhabit relatively impoverished lands. So, you know, the calculus is conquering these people is going to be more of it than it's worth. So why don't we just encapsulate them? Why don't we just physically encapsulate them on a reservation, but also legally and culturally encapsulate them, make them non-subjects or non-citizens, make them objects of our law, tell them they're not ruled through our norms, but through their own customs and traditions, as long as we get to oversee those. So I think that's one thing that's going on. But the other point that your question brings up, which I think is really important, is the actual physical location of either the Fatah in Afghanistan or San Carlos in Arizona, or indeed many of the places I look at in Argentina, which is on an international border, where on the one hand, you have these people that you're fencing in, encapsulating, putting on a reservation, but they abut or they're very close to a recognized power, foreign power very close by. In Argentina's case, it's Chile. In the United States, it's Mexico. And in the British case, it's kind of Afghanistan, but then more importantly and more concerningly further afield is Russia. And so I do think that their particular place in the geography, the political geography of the emerging states of the time is really important and needs to be, one needs to pay attention to the particular places these things happen.
So you are an historian. You are an historian of modern South Asia. And, you know, a lot of people might think, well, what's the relevance of what Ben Hopkins has revealed in Ruling the Savage Periphery about the 1870s and 1880s in various parts of the world to the current situation where, you know, people talk about neocolonialism, but colonialism is, let me venture to say, less of a factor today, at least in its traditional form, than it was back then. So what lessons are you trying to impart about how nation states treat their citizens or at least certain populations that we can learn from today, that we can, you know, how can it help us understand power dynamics today?
Thank you very much for that question, C.S. The book begins and ends not in the 1870s, as we have been discussing, but actually rather in modern day. And it specifically begins with a series of attacks that are by most commentators viewed as interlinked by the global war on terror. And that's in 2014, the attack on the Army Public School in Peshawar, the attack on Garissa University in Kenya, and the attack that ended up in the kidnapping of 276 girls by Boko Haram in Chibok in northern Nigeria. So people generally use the frame of terrorism to tie these geographically disparate places together. It's a very modernist linkage of them. But the book argues that actually they're tied by much deeper linkages than that. Linkages that go back to the construction of the modern state order, which peripheralized these places. They made them backwaters. They made them places that could be subject to such horrific violence. And since we've been talking so much about the San Carlos Reservation in Arizona, I'd add that that violence is not only actual, like we see with people going in and killing others, but it's also manifests itself in other ways. So for instance, the San Carlos Reservation is one of the poorest in the United States, one of the most disenfranchised, you know, and the United States government as recently as the late 2010s was still doing takings from the San Carlos Reservation and the San Carlos tribe in the form of a major copper mine that sits on tribal land, and the tribe didn't want to give up the land, so the government just takes it. The other point I would make is actually, it's not only me making the argument there is something going on here, but 2 years ago, Congress passed something called the Global Fragility Act. And I was talking to a colleague over at the State Department the other day, and he started talking about the places that the Global Fragility Act, which is looking at the United States trying to engage in these kind of problematic spaces that kind of have state authority and kind of don't, a lot of terrorism, not really clear. But this individual at the State Department was listing the places they're looking at. And as he was listing them, I was laughing because I was like, that's exactly the same spots that my book is about. It's about the Kenya-Somali frontier, northern Nigeria. It's about the Afghan-Pakistan frontier, spaces that end up today in the media and in the news. So it's not only a historian view saying, hey, look, this is a moment in the past, but I also think it's a moment today. And if I could finish in your question, C.S., you said that people think of colonialism as something that happened back then. But as we have already discussed, colonialism and imperialism is not something that ends with decolonization, for instance, of the Indian subcontinent in 1947, or, you know, the decolonization of the African subcontinent in the 1960s and 70s. Rather, it's something that continues today, just in altered form.
Benjamin Hopkins, Associate Professor of History and International Affairs at the George Washington University. His books include The Making of Modern Afghanistan and Fragments of the Afghan Frontier, which he co-authored with Magnus Marsden. We've been talking about two things. His latest book, it's called Ruling the Savage Periphery, Frontier Governance and the Making of the Modern State, and an article that he wrote that was recently published in the Journal of Critical Asian Studies. It's called The War That Destroyed America, Afghanistan's Coming Bill. Ben, thank you so much for your work, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, CS. It's been a pleasure.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.